Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kim Ives, an editor at the Haiti Progrès newspaper, who examines the forces that may have been behind the latest coup attempt against the government of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide; Steve Hawkins of the Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, who analyzes the latest developments in the case of death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal; and Dan Hirsch of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, who discusses the vulnerability of nuclear power plants both to accidents and to terrorist attacks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
When inmate Lonnie Thomas first entered the Nebraska State Penitentiary in the mid-1990s, he wanted to be a model prisoner. He took college classes and earned a degree in business administration. He also went to a support group for HIV-positive inmates. Yet Thomas' fortunes went sour when he sought protection from a cellmate who threatened to assault him. 4 years ago, the prison put Thomas, a gay man, into solitary confinement. He's never gotten out of the hole, restricted to an 8-by-10-foot cell with only 1 hour of exercise a day. Thomas's lawyer, Amy Miller of the Nebraska ACLU, says prison officials have never fully explained why the HIV prisoner is still in isolation, and he will likely stay there until his scheduled release in July 2002. Miller told the news magazine In These Times that Thomas asked for help and they just threw away the lock and key. Early on in the AIDS crisis, state prisons segregated most HIV and AIDS inmates. That practice stopped as the number of inmates dying from AIDS fell in recent years. But the rate of HIV infection has started to increase again, following a similar trend in the general population. Merrick Buckingham of My Brother's Keeper, a support group for HIV-positive gay prisoners from communities of color, feels the use of solitary confinement is mean-spirited. He explained, "It fuels the fire of infection behind the walls, since people will not seek out testing if they know they might be placed in segregation." Although lead was taken out of gasoline over 15 years ago, the dangerous metal finds its way into the bloodstream of over 1 million children a year, mostly in poor minority neighborhoods. Researchers point the finger at cracking lead paint that is found in many urban communities. E, the environmental magazine, reports that public interest lawyers and civil rights groups are going after the lead paint industry for millions of dollars in damages in a new barrage of lawsuits that resembles the flurry of plaintiff lawsuits against the tobacco industry. Last summer, NAACP President Kwesi Mfume blasted lead poisoning as a silent epidemic affecting many African American communities. 2 years ago, the Providence Journal newspaper cited a health study showing the extent of the problem in minority neighborhoods. 16% of Latino children and 24% of Black and Asian children had lead poisoning, while only 8% of white youngsters tested positive in blood tests. Arthur Bryant of Trial Lawyers for Public Justice charged there is little doubt that the lead industry knew that lead paint was poisoning kids for years. High-profile Baltimore trial lawyer Peter Angelos, who won billions in claims from the tobacco and asbestos industries, is now putting his clout behind the lawsuits aimed at the lead industry. Still, there is no certainty of obtaining justice for the victims of lead poisoning. In the mid-1990s, Maryland state courts dismissed a lawsuit against the lead industry, ruling that there was no factual evidence showing that companies conspired to conceal the knowledge of the dangers of lead paint. Sierra magazine reports that large lumber companies are clear-cutting the old growth forests of interior British Columbia. With the blessing of the provincial government, half of the trees of the Chilcotin Forest were cut from 1996 to 1998. Clear cuts account for nearly all of the major lumber operations in British Columbia. Recently, the government of British Columbia agreed to stop logging in the Great Bear Rainforest, a 1.5 million acre area home to 800-year-old cedar trees, streams full of salmon, and the white Kermode, or spirit bear. But the BC government is still pressing its pro-clear-cutting policy. Trees are falling in big numbers in the interior Chilcotin Forest, home to old-growth trees, some over 200 years old. Canadian environmentalists soon may have a chance to halt clear-cutting. They are working with U.S. timber companies to file a complaint with the U.S. Commerce Department, claiming that Canadian exporters should pay a penalty for dumping wood products on U.S. markets and displacing American workers. Commerce has recommended a punitive tariff be placed on all Canadian wood imports. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the early morning hours of December the 17th, 30 armed men stormed Haiti's presidential palace in an apparent coup attempt against the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The attackers, who were reported to have worn the uniforms of the disbanded Haitian army, killed two policemen before one of their number was killed by police in a six-hour shootout. Haitian authorities captured two involved in the coup attempt, but the others escaped, fleeing toward the border with the Dominican Republic. As reports of the attack reached the Haitian people, thousands of Aristide supporters poured into the streets. Around the country, crowds attacked and killed four people who were suspected of collaborating with the coup plotters. This is the second incident of serious violence visited upon Haiti since Aristide won a second term as president last November. Aristide first won the presidency in 1990, but was overthrown in a bloody military coup 7 months into his term. The popular former Catholic priest was later reinstalled by a combined US-UN force in 1994. Many observers see this latest episode of violence as a sign of sharpening conflict between the poor majority of the country and the wealthy elite whose party, the Democratic Convergence, boycotted last November's election. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Kim Ives, an editor at the New York City-based Haiti Progrès newspaper, who examines the forces that may have been behind this latest coup attempt.
The Haitian government is saying that the assailants, when they took the palace, got a hold of a palace radio and blustered into the radio that their head was a guy called Guy Philippe. Now, Guy Philippe was a former police chief from Cape Haitian who went into exile about a year ago, last October, when he and 13 other police chiefs were discovered to be plotting a coup, or at least that was the charge of the Haitian government. They fled to the Dominican Republic. This circle was called the Ecuadorians because they were sort of plucked from the military academy during the coup d'etat and under a U.S. Financed scholarship went to Ecuador, where they were trained by U.S. Special Forces and Ecuadorian Special Forces. And they were brought back to Haiti and were sort of superstars in the police force, and they rose very quickly. And some people in the Haitian government believe they were sort of sleepers, that is, agents which weren't immediately activated, but, you know, were waiting for their moment. And that moment was last October, just prior to Aristide's re-election. They all went into exile into the Dominican Republic, which gave them political asylum. And it is believed that they're working from there and that this is the crew that's responsible for planning and organizing this strike. The precise relationship with the Convergence, no, they've taken care not to make any links, if there are any, but the Convergence certainly, you know, benefits from this kind of attack, even though they're saying that the whole thing is a fabrication of the government.
Could you tell us, Kim Ives, about the Bush administration and their attitude toward President Aristide and what, if any, possible connections they may have with those groups that are working to undermine him or overthrow him?
The Bush administration clearly is no fan of the Aristide government. We have to remember that when the first coup happened, it was George Bush Sr. who was in power, and they did nothing to try to turn back the coup. On the contrary, they were very hypocritically supporting the coup, practically. And it was, I should also add, that it was learned almost around the time that the U.S. troops brought him back, that in fact the CIA and the Pentagon were present in military headquarters when the coup was going down and helped create some of the paramilitary terrorist organizations that helped maintain the coup. That organization in particular was called the FRAP, and the leader of it now enjoys de facto political asylum here in New York City. But today, what's happening is they're doing kind of an embargo. The Haitian government has received, for example, $146 million of loans from the Inter-American Development Bank. But just as these loans were about to be dispersed to cover a lot of, you know, very critical social and economic needs in the country, schools, hospitals, so forth. I mean, we have to remember Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. This $146 million of loans was blocked by the U.S., which has veto power in the Inter-American Development Bank. So this is what Aristide today is calling economic terrorism. And, of course, the Bush people don't like this very much. The Black Caucus is trying to swing into action and is trying to pressure to get these funds released. We don't think they're going to have too much success in that. In fact, there's really about $562 million, over half $1 billion, which has been pledged to Haiti, but none of that has arrived since the U.S. is really sort of trying to choke off the country and let the Lavalas self-destruct.
What's the outlook for the Aristide government? He's got 4 more years in office, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, the outlook isn't bright from our point of view. We feel that, you know, he's making a lot of the same errors the Sandinistas did, which is thinking that he can appease Washington by making concessions. I mean, in a way, the concessions end up hurting him more. He's integrated into his party a lot of Duvalierists. These are people from the old dictatorship who worked for the old dictator, who have nothing in common with the democratic nationalist movement that was born in 1990. And by integrating them into the party, it has really made the whole compass of the party gyrate, and people have become very confused and disillusioned and disaffected. And so I think the party is becoming very weak and losing the confidence of the people. And, you know, this is a grave error.
That was Kim Ives, an editor at the New York City-based Haiti Progrès newspaper. Contact Haiti Progrès at 718-434-8100 or visit its website at www.haitiprogres.com. In a major development in one of the nation's most closely watched capital punishment cases, federal judge William Yohn announced his decision to throw out the death sentence against Mumia Abu-Jamal, convicted of the 1981 murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Jamal, an award-winning journalist on Pennsylvania's death row for 20 years, has drawn attention to his case through radio commentaries and the publication of several books critical of the U.S. justice system. Thousands of supporters across the globe have demanded the 47-year-old former Black Panther be freed or receive a new trial. Judge Yohn's decision, issued December the 18th, upheld Jamal's first-degree murder conviction, but ruled that the state must conduct a new sentencing hearing within 6 months, or a life sentence without parole would be imposed. Jamal's supporters have vowed to appeal the decision to press their demand for a new trial that would include the testimony of Ronald Beverly, who recently confessed that he, and not Jamal, killed Daniel Faulkner. Officer Faulkner's wife and many police officials have bitterly condemned the judge's ruling. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Hawkins, an attorney who for 6 years represented Mumia Abu-Jamal and now serves as the executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Hawkins analyzes the latest developments in Jamal's case and how they may affect the movement to end capital punishment.
Judge Yohn has only overturned Mumia's death sentence, not the underlying conviction. And because of that, Mumia is now entitled to a new sentencing hearing. And what the judge found was that the jury in the initial sentencing hearing was not allowed to individually consider mitigating evidence, evidence that would allow the jury to vote for a sentence less than death. The jury was led to believe, and this was a big error, that they had to agree unanimously on anything that was of mitigating value. So that's really the sum of Judge Yohn's ruling.
What will be allowed to be heard in such a hearing? Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, of course, want the issue of guilt or innocence to come up. Can it come up in such a sentencing hearing?
Is it possible to get the jury to focus on the question of, is the right person before them for sentencing? Yes, there is a narrow window because there's something called lingering doubt about guilt, which has been in the law for a while, which is a strange concept, but We have seen in Virginia, for example, where several governors have commuted death sentences. Even though the person has been convicted, the governor said, I still have a lingering doubt as to whether the system really got it right. And the attorneys may very well argue to the jury that the system has the wrong man, and make that part of their argument as to why a sentence of death should not be imposed. And it would be very critical to Mumia's whole defense if the jury was to come back and say, we refuse to sentence this man to death because we still believe that there is a lingering doubt about his guilt. I phrase it that way, Scott, because clearly there were several egregious errors, major constitutional violations that happened at Mumia's trial, and the judge should have granted him a new trial for a complete determination of guilt and innocence, but that has not happened. And Mumia's lawyers will appeal the decision of the federal court.
Steve Hawkins, could you describe the wider significance of this judge's decision in the Mumia Abu-Jamal case for those advocating abolition of the death penalty?
Mumia's case represents very clearly how difficult it is for people who have credible claims of innocence to get that evidence heard in federal court. We have heard of people who have been released from death row on grounds of innocence. Most of those people have been incredibly lucky, frankly, to be able to get released. DNA has cleared perhaps a quarter of them now. Others have been able to get critical evidence heard. But we all know, someone like myself who's been involved in death penalty defense for 13 years now, we all know of cases where people have been executed where there were serious doubts about their guilt. And Mumia is in that situation where he's fighting for his life to get his evidence heard. So it underscores for those of us who are opposed to the death penalty still the difficulties that exist. And why is it so important that these cases get heard is that they help to really reveal all of the problems that underlie how the death penalty is used in the United States. Mumia's attorney, for example, at the original trial, had no experience with any death penalty trials. He was only given $150 to hire an investigator, which was just completely unrealistic. And that is how poor people, time and again, are subject to the death penalty in the United States. The other issue, of course, is racial bias. Philadelphia had a very clear history of keeping black people off of capital juries, and it was furthered by having someone like Judge Szabo send more people to death row than any other judge in the country. And of all the people he sent to death row, all but two of the people were African American or Latino. I do not think that Mumia would have gotten even the relief that he did, a new sentencing hearing, without the kind of activism that has taken place both nationally and internationally. There have been, you know, hundreds of people on the streets in Philadelphia, thousands of people on the streets in Paris and other parts of the world, and all of that pressure has certainly helped to make his case certainly well known, but also I think to further his chances in court. Many people believe that Mumia was very much specifically targeted by the Philadelphia police. He was well known. He was writing about the injustices and the police brutality in Philadelphia at the time this happened. I frankly have found that most people who get relief from death row in the United States get relief because somebody makes known what is happening in their case. I don't think that most people get relief silently because the courts just work out the problems and the kinks.
That was Steve Hawkins, Executive Director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Contact the coalition by calling 888-286-2237 or visit its website at www.ncadp.org. Ah! vulnerability of nuclear power plants to both accidents and terrorist attacks has been an issue of great concern to some from the inception of the nuclear age. In the wake of September the 11th, the problem has taken on a new urgency. The Committee to Bridge the Gap is a nuclear policy organization based in Los Angeles that provides technical assistance to communities in which nuclear plants are located. It has been working, mostly behind the scenes, for more than 20 years to try to improve security at the nation's nuclear power plants, which now number 103. These plants also store, on-site, large quantities of high-level radioactive spent fuel, with even less security than at the plants themselves. After failing to make much progress convincing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to take steps to increase security, the Committee to Bridge the Gap recently went public with its concerns at a news conference at the National Press Club. Dan Hirsch helped found the committee 30 years ago and currently serves as its president. He spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus about what he believes to be the root of the problem of nuclear plant safety and what should be done.
I've written an article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists that discloses the quarter-century-old regulations that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has for protecting reactors against sabotage, and discloses that those regulations are extraordinarily outmoded, requiring only that a facility protect against no more than three terrorists operating as a single group and no more than a single insider. And this is just grossly inadequate in light of the terrorist threat.
Does your organization think that nuclear power is inherently unsafe?
I think that our view of matters is that it's not so much the technology that's the problem as the human beings who have to manage the technology. It's a very unforgiving technology. You cannot make a mistake. And I think we've become increasingly skeptical of the nature of the ability of our institutions, both private industry that runs the facilities and this very weak regulator, the NRC, that's supposed to assure that the industry does the right thing. We're very skeptical about the ability of those two institutions to handle such a dangerous technology. But if you have a situation where there's a tremendous profit incentive to keep costs down so you don't put a lot of money into safety or security, and if you have a political system where campaign contributions can buy you power with regulators so that they are essentially captured by the industry they're supposed to regulate, under circumstances like that, it's a technology that is too dangerous for our existing institutions to handle.
Have you gone to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission with specific proposals for how to make these 103 operating nuclear power plants safer from terrorist attacks?
Yes, and we've done that repeatedly for 20 years. For example, in 1984, the Sandia National Laboratory performed a study that found that the nation's reactors could be destroyed by truck bombs. Extraordinary finding. And at that time, the NRC did not require any protection against truck bombs, despite all the truck bombs that were being blown up in the Mideast. They only required you to protect against three terrorists on foot. The terrorists could not use a vehicle. And so we disclosed that. We testified before the NRC. And after a decade's worth of pushing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, eventually the NRC put in place a rule that requires some measure of protection against truck bombs. It's not enough in our view, but at least that did occur. But our efforts to change the rest of the regulations have failed. You still only have to protect against three external attackers. And what's extraordinary about that is even with such a minimal threat basis, roughly half of the reactors in the United States have failed mock terrorist attacks. And understand this, the day of the attack is known by the reactor operator 6 months in advance. And even so, half of the exercises result in the mock terrorists being able to penetrate security and get to the target set that if they were real terrorists, they could produce a meltdown.
Do you sleep at night?
Yes, but mainly because I work very hard to change all of this. The number of casualties that could result from either a reactor or a spent fuel pool being destroyed, these numbers are just immense. And for example, there's a reactor near Los Angeles called San Onofre that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission years ago estimated a meltdown could result in 130,000 deaths within a few days and 300,000 latent cancers and 600,000 genetic effects, nearly 900,000 health effects from a meltdown or a terrorist attack at one of those reactors. We decided to go forward with a technology that is so dangerous that if you lose the coolant or you lose the electricity to run the pumps to move the coolant, the fuel can melt or burn and the radioactivity be released. And we decided to cut corners on our siting rules so that we've now placed a number of these reactors quite close to very, very large population areas. And I think that September 11th has made very clear to most people in this country that this is an extraordinarily dangerous technology. And if the existing generation of reactors are vulnerable to terrorist attack, the public, I think, will be even less willing to accept the new generation of reactors the industry proposed. These are called pebble bed reactors, which would be built without a containment structure, that thick concrete dome designed to try to keep radioactivity in. In order to save money, they will have no containment structure or no conventional one. So if a water-cooled reactor with a containment structure is vulnerable to a terrorist attack, imagine the risks of having a flammable reactor built with no containment structure. I should also say that there's a very dangerous effort underfoot by the industry to use September 11th as a way of preventing public scrutiny of the safety problems with nuclear power by removing from the websites and from public document rooms any kind of document that indicates the safety problems that these reactors have. And about the only thing that saved us to date has been that there is some measure of public scrutiny, which has forced the industry to be a bit more on its toes.
That was Dan Hirsch, president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap. Contact the committee by calling area code 831-462-6136. You've been listening to Between the Lines, weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.